broadcasting before and probably after the rapture. It's the Drew Marshall Show.
Song have to do with our next guest? You're pretty good at you just want to play Steve Miller? Was that it?
No, you're making me play it. You can explain.
All right. That's not right. About these people, that drove around and broke into places and stuff.
Yeah, that's not good.
What a show we've had today. Alicia, Britt, Sholi. Why can't I say this? I've asked you 7 times. I'm going to write it down phonetically.
Sholi. Sholi the money.
She's the author of 40 Days of Decrease, A Different Kind of Hunger, A Different Kind of Fast. Alicia, thank you for joining us. The website is aliciasholi.com, but good luck you figuring out how to spell Sholi. C-H-O-L-E.com. Alicia, do you hate me for playing a song about people who used to break into places and take the money and run? Do you hate me?
Nope. Thought never occurred to me, Drew. No, I'm good.
Oh. Well, speaking of decrease, thank you for joining us. You're a very positive person. Why are you positive? Is it because you love Jesus? Is that why you're positive? Or were you born positive and then loved Jesus? What happened?
I don't know that I'd call myself positive. I think most people who know me really well describe me as a diplomatic realist.
Oh, nice.
I am hopeful.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being hopeful. I have the spiritual gift of pessimism, so I don't think I can back it up with a verse or anything, but, you know. So as far as Lent is concerned, my only real experience with Lent was pancakes. And in 1 week, a few years ago, I gave up my eyesight for the last week of Lent. So I put these contact lenses in that took away my vision for a week, and I tried to do a normal week. I had speaking engagements, did the radio show, rode my horse, walked around, you know, whatever. And it was interesting. It was a very interesting experience. But that's really all I've got with Lent. Because when I think of Lent, I really think of, people give up chocolate, they give up Pop-Tarts, I don't know, whatever. And I think we're really missing the boat. As typical Westerners, right? We go, well, let's give up materialism, but it's more than just materialism. It's more than just chocolate. And that's why you're on the show today, is to help us figure out how we can decrease, right? A different kind of hunger, a different kind of fast. So where did this original sort of conviction or stirring come from inside of you?
Well, I think that we have a whole lot of heart clutter. I think that both externally and internally, we've just got too much stuff. We're doing too much stuff. We're collecting too much stuff, and it weighs us down. And I think that when we're weighed down in that way, whether it's externally or internally, we have a hard time seeing what's important. And so when I was actually working on my dissertation, I was thinking about themes like disillusionment and decrease and discouragement, and what overflowed from that dissertation was to do something practical to help people, hopefully, reduce some of their heart clutter so they can see what's really important in life and live lighter on the inside, which will certainly help us live lighter externally as well.
Well, let's talk about a high fever and a few scans and multiple masses and possibly a lethal abscess.
Okay. Yes. So several years ago, I was surprised by finding, through an ER visit, that I had a couple things going on. And it, took me into surgery and canceled everything, obviously, that everything was benign. Later on, I wound up being diagnosed with breast cancer, and I can talk about that, too, if you'd like. But during that time, it was really my first introduction to breathtaking pain. And my organs refused to wake up after the surgery for months and months and months. And it was spiritually quite an experience for me. Of course, it reduced. I called it the reduction because all of a sudden this massive to-do list that we think is so incredibly important at all vaporizes in the heat of pain. And all you're left with is this need to be loved and to be taken care of. And I found that the helplessness actually was a spiritual friend. The helplessness started sifting the stuff inside of me. And what it revealed, I think, is what I referred to in the book called Sins of Addition. You know, wasn't like I was suddenly aware of all sorts of stuff that I did that I shouldn't have done or that I should have done and I didn't do. It was like I was starting to add things to the purity of peace and the purity of faith. And all of a sudden, for me, it started to be, you know, Jesus plus something or else equals contentment, and Jesus plus something or else equals satisfaction. And all of the pluses were weighing down my heart, and the pain, wow, the pain vaporized it and got me down to, I think, something a little bit more pure and certainly something more livable.
Okay. How are you, though, now? I mean, this is, you know, how long ago was this again? It was when?
Yeah, that was a long time ago. That first surgery was about 10 years ago. And then 2013, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And then just last fall, had another little symptom removed that everybody thought was just fat necrosis, and it wound up being cancer as well. So how am I doing? Yeah. I am, how do I say that? My children have stopped asking me if I'm going to die.
Wow.
You know, it speaks a little bit to the trauma and the stress and the anxiety that the loved ones around us have when we walk through something like this. I think I'm good, Drew. I feel I like life, and I'm not afraid of death. So I feel good. I feel full and rich on the inside, and my body is doing well, as far as we know.
How old are your kids?
My kids, 18 and a half, 12 and a half, and 9. All ours through the miracle of adoption, and they all have mild to moderate special needs. They're extraordinary souls.
Okay, stop. Stop.
Beautiful.
Stop for a second.
Stop. I'm stopping. I'm listening.
I'm adopted, so yay you for adopting.
Yeah.
But I think you're nuts. For adopting 3, and I want to know if you knew they had special needs stuff before you adopted them, or did you get a little special gift surprise afterwards?
Yeah, I'd say yes to both of those. We knew we wanted to adopt, and even before we got married, and we knew there was a good chance that our eldest might have some challenges, but we knew that our middle, she was cocaine exposed in utero, and our youngest was meth exposed and just a whole variety of other things as well. So how we went in knowing there might be challenges, and with 2 of the 3 that there, you know, almost certainly would be challenges. But yeah, special needs are shadows of special strengths, and my kids are extraordinary. They're incredible.
You people scare me. You people. No, you do, because, like, okay, I'm adopted, so obviously I'm thankful that I was adopted, and I was adopted into a great family, and it all worked out well, and it was good, and, I mean, I was a jerk to my parents, but, you know, we came out on the other side. But when I think about doing it myself, I go completely white, and I can't even think about it. I'd rather talk about abortion, which is just a subject we talked about earlier today, and that's a really awkward, tough subject to talk about. Mm-hmm. I would rather talk about the subject of abortion than about adoption, because it scares me, and... Sorry, we're getting off track here. I'm just...
Oh, okay.
But I mean, and you've adopted 3, and you've got the special needs, and, you know, I've got a friend in Nashville who couldn't wait any longer for Mr. Wright to come along, so she adopted Mr. Wright from Russia and over there in his orphanage and stuff. And boy, it comes with baggage and issues and problems. And now you got the coke and the meth and the... I'm stressed on your behalf.
But love is vulnerable, right? I mean, love is always going to be vulnerable. And I think that, you know, every step, whether, you know, it's through biologically or whether it's foster children or, you know, adoptive, love makes you vulnerable. And so when you choose to love, you set yourself up for the potential of either acceptance or rejection. Mm. And so you decide whether it's worth it or not. And we feel like it is.
Okay, I don't want to talk about this anymore. So let's go to how you put a big target on your head by being all about decrease. Right here you go. You release this book, 40 Days of Decrease, a different kind of hunger, a different kind of fast. And now what? People expect you to live in some mobile home? Right? As soon as they see you driving a nice car, they think, oh, there's the decrease lady.
Yeah, when I'm leading the tiny house trend or something. No, I think it's pretty clear that though we do live in the country and our car has, 250,000 miles on, I think we might qualify for that part as well. But our focus is really the decrease in the heart stuff. So what this book does is it leads us through all kinds of different fasts. So if you want to fast, social media or designer coffee or chocolate, that's all well and good. I think in a self-indulgent age, any form of fasting is to be commended. But what the book talks about is we lead people in fasting things like regret. And why don't we fast tidy faith or speeding past sorrow? We fast avoidance and hypocrisy and denial and comparison and criticism. So it's kind of a heart workout for 40 days.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I loved writing it. I loved living it while I'm writing it, and I'll be living it for the rest of my days.
Yeah, but hold on. This is one of those easier said than done things. I mean, it's easier. It's so much easier to fast, even though most of us are addicted to coffee or chocolate. It's so much easier to fast that than it is to fast from discontentment or fasting intimidation or abstaining from isolation I should reach out to people more or whatever. Now, there's one here, fasting your voice, and that includes talking and typing and texting. Mm-hmm. I'm planning on a month and a half silent retreat coming up soon.
Oh, love that. That sounds great.
Yeah, but I don't know if I can do it. Somebody said to me, it's so, no, but not from being, it's so instantaneous, right? You stub your toe and you say something. Sometimes stuff you can't say on radio. And so I'm going to have to put tape over my mouth for the first week, literally. Just to make sure I don't accidentally say something. Anyway.
But I think the thing is, whether it's your voice or whether any of the above, I think that what makes fasting powerful is to contextualize it in relationship. I believe that fasting, in order to be effective, is relational. So, with all of these kind of different things, if we start with self in order to end with self, we clearly don't gain much ground. And so I think that if we think of fasting relationally with our God, that this is a relational experience, and with our community, it all of a sudden becomes three-dimensional. Instead of something we measure or we count off or we either got right or got wrong, we're starting to measure movement instead of like accomplishment or completion. And that to me is the heart of what makes any form of fasting effective. Number one, it's relational. Hmm. And number two, we're talking about movement, not some kind of quantifiable experiment. And so, with your silence, I think in the context of, you may be silent audibly, but in order for it to be relational, there'll be this internal conversation happening that's watering the core of your faith.
You're good.
Wow.
Hey, she's good, eh?
She is. I'm writing some of this stuff down.
Which is, he's never done that before. He just learned how to write, so it's kind of a big thing.
I've been fasting on intelligence for years now.
Let's talk, up next after you, I don't know if you realize this, but the grandson of Gandhi is following you. His name is Arun Gandhi, and we had him on the show last week, and we just felt we wanted to have him back again, so he was gracious and kind enough to come back on our show again. And, I mean, you don't get much more fasty than Gandhi. You don't get much more denial of self than Gandhi. And I think one of the reasons people don't really hunker down into fasting, into Lenti fasting stuff, is because they think, if I'm going to do this, I got to be like, full on. I got to be Gandhi-ish. What do you say to those people that just get... I don't know, they get all hung up over the fact that they think they have to go big or go home when it comes to this stuff.
Well, again, I'd return back to relationship. I think that the why is what makes fasting spiritually meaningful. I think we've got to identify the why. So just to tackle something to do, I mean, isn't that sort of experience for experience sake? But if this is relational, then... perhaps the intensity of it isn't the goal. It's cooperation. It's doing it with God. It's doing it for relationship. One of the things that I say in the book is that the love for God is what makes any of these pursuits holy. Hmm. So disciplines without love are going to produce something far less than worship. whether it's increase or whether it's decrease, if we do it for the love of God, all of a sudden, it's not just a thing to do. Now it's an offering.
Website, yeah. AliciaSholey.com. That's C-H-O-L-E, Sholey.com. And you'll find out about her book, 40 Days of Decrease, A Different Kind of Hunger, A Different Kind of Fast. Is there one thing, one time that you have fasted from something in the past that had such a leftover residual impact on you that you it still impacts you? Because, again, most of us, and I love how you're about the whys and you're about the relationship, right? Why am I doing this, and is it relationship-based? Whether it's relationship with yourself, relationship with others, relationship with God. But most of the time when fasting is done, eventually, you know, it's kind of like, I'll get to the question here eventually, but it's kind of like when you go away on a mission trip and you see all the poor kids and the poor people, and then you come back and you get angry at everybody in North America because we're all so rich, and eventually you get back to North Americanism. You get swallowed up by it. So is there something that happened to you during a Lent thing or a fasting thing over the years that is still whooping your butt today?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me just briefly mention, I spent the first chunk of my life as a very sincere and certain atheist. And so when I'm talking about fasting and connecting it with relationship with Jesus, that's the treasure there. That's the gold. And so I would say that in that regard, the two fasts that have deeply, deeply affected me. One was a year-long fast from accumulating anything, from buying anything, period, from shampoo to shoes. I purchased nothing for myself for a year. And another one was a year-long fast from all sugar. And I think that, you know, taking yourself out. You had to say it. There you go.
I had to. I'm too ADD not to say that.
I had to do it. But I think that part of it is when we do go without these things, when we think about, you know, the physical kind of fast, I think it reminds us of what we can't buy. And, you know, some of the things you were mentioning in your last interview, the grace, the mercy, we can't buy those things. And I think that especially the fasting from buying anything or accumulating anything, I'm still bearing the fruit of that, of just realizing that I truly need less. But that there's also so many gifts that come that money can't buy. There's just no way to purchase them. It's just grace.
When you get tired, exhausted, because you have three kids, you have three adopted kids, you have special needs kids, and every husband is special needs, what do you do? What do you turn into? What do you turn to when you just get exhausted and you're just in the funk? What do you do?
Yeah. Well, I lean introvert, Drew, and so I go to silence and art to try to be renewed. Or I go somewhere outside. We live out in the country, and I like the unmanicured stuff. I like the wild woods. Concrete, you know, makes me feel like I don't have enough air to breathe. So I will head out and see things that are just wild and untamed, and that just does something for my soul. And then I sleep more, I enjoy more silence, and I'll pick up a paintbrush or head to the piano.
I don't have a lot of really good Jesus-y spiritual stuff. Now, what am I trying to say here? What I'm trying to say is you're a legit member of the Jesus tribe that I actually like. But I don't know you, so that's a goofy thing to say. But what I'm trying to say is I really like the way you've come across in this interview. You have an ease about you and a really gentle spirit and a humility. And anybody that adopts three kids has me right there, first of all. And then you throw in the special needs. You got me. So I will actually read your book from front to back.
Okay.
No, I get like seven books a week, and I just don't have time. Like I'm legit special needs. I dropped out of high school at grade 9, so I have reading problems. But you've got me here, and I don't like that. So thank you.
Drew, I'm so grateful for the opportunity to talk to you. Thank you. It was very gracious of you to reach out to somebody you've never heard of, and thank you for the opportunity to share about the book and what's in my heart.
Well, I hope sometime, I know you've had a tough day today, so I hope sometime you experience some good questions, some honesty, and some thunderstorms, and something with jalapenos.
Oh, thank you. Those are my loves.
Thank you, Alicia.
Thank you. Oh, hey, thank you, Drew. You take care.
Bye-bye. I like that lady. Hey, you know what I'm saying about her spirit?
Yeah, it's just really chill.
Yeah, I feel mellow. I'm telling you, that adoption stuff freaks me out. And some people say, oh, it's because you're convicted and it's God pushing. I don't know.
No, because you are one.
That's probably it.
And you get how hard it is for both sides, really.
I wouldn't have wanted to adopt me.
No.
Can you imagine that?